You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts. As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, delicious friends, and welcome back to Who Did What Now, the history podcast that's not your history class, with me, your host, Katie Charlewood, history harlot and reader of books. Welcome back, everybody. It is the first episode of the new year, and I know we're like halfway through January, and you did get like Dick Turpin technically as a delayed sort of thing, but I've not been well. And then I was away in Munich in Germany for work, so that was fun. So I've kind of been all over the place a little bit, and I just got back last night, actually. At 10 p.m. was when I finally got home. And so today, I was like, no, I had my notes done for days, actually, because I was prepared for this. And I was like, I need to be ready to go so that when I get home, I can just, like, set up the computer, set up the microphone, and just get back to doing what we do best. Talking about people from history who have been misrepresented generally through the eyes of the pale and stale males, thus, as we know, just poisoning our perception of, you know, cool people. I mean, sometimes, you know, people do dodgy shit and that's fine. But we support women's rights and we support women's wrongs. And you know me, I don't believe in slut shaming, I believe in slut faming, and that is why we are talking about who we're talking about today, because I thought, let's start the year as we mean to go on. Not late, because that's not great, but like the other stuff. So news before we get into anything else. I have a live show coming up in Dublin on the 3rd of February, Saturday, 3rd of February, 2024. And it is the bank holiday weekend. And of course, we are celebrating the day just like Bridget would want us to. Talking about salacious women from history while wearing a dress that shows just a little bit too much cleavage. And that is just how we do it. Because again, I am your favourite history harlot. And I think the first, like so many tickets, because I did a January sale, are like only a tenner and the rest are 15. So like, you should totally come see me at Hysteria Chenet in Dublin. It's super fun. I did my gig there before and I had somebody message like, hey, where else in Europe are you going to be? And I'm like, I don't know. It's January and I literally organized this like, I think just after Christmas or just after New Year's. I was like, hey, I'll come do a show. Yeah. And they're like, yeah, cool. So I haven't got anything else organized yet. But if you're in Europe and you want me to do a live show, I'm just saying, let me know. I'll come. Well, I mean, we'll see if you're cool and not like an arsehole. But yeah, it's been a time of it because I was sick. I had pneumonia, as many of you who follow the socials will know. And yeah, it's been like straight from one thing into work. And then I'm still not like tip top, but it's fine. Then I had to go to Germany. And then I went to Munich, but then saw like none of Munich. So that was fun. But I did eat many, many pretzels. There was a pudding pretzel. That was the term, pudding pretzel. Who knew that was a thing? Like a dessert pretzel. It was delicious though. It had like a custard situation going on. Fucking amazing. Absolutely loved it. And then at breakfast, there was salami in the shape of pretzels. I mean, when I tell you, I had my fill of pretzels and I bloody love pretzels. These were just the perfect German experience for, I don't know, a little tourist like me. I say tourist if I wasn't working, but like, you know what I mean? It was super fun. But I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, quit your jibber jabber and fact me. And fact you I will. But first, we've got to get our source on. Our sources are Queen of Hearts, Marguerite of Valois, by Charlotte Haldane. The Rival Queens, Catherine de Medici, her daughter Marguerite de Valois, and The Betrayal That Ignited a Kingdom, by Nancy Goldstone. The Myth of Reine Margot, by Robert J. Seeley. The French Wars of Religion, 1559-1598, by Robert J. Knecht. Marguerite de Valois, La Reine Margot, by Eliane Vigneault. The Memoirs of Marguerite de Valois, by Marguerite de Valois. And of course we have our favourites, History.com, History Extra, and Biography.com. I use it in comfortably. Good, then let's begin. So here is a woman I've wanted to talk about for like a long time, but I try not to stay within the Renaissance or like post-Renaissance like too much because, you know, there's so much other history out there that's just wild and fascinating and wonderful. But this period in history, those sort of 1400s, 1500s, they are wild. Like, it's clear that Europe is ruled by a bunch of teenagers for like a long time. Like, it's just as you would imagine it would be. Like, let's put teenagers on the throne. Let's see how it goes. Spoiler alert, not well, but fascinating history nonetheless. But yes, all this stuff is happening for like quite a long time. And then, just one thing after another, and this story has everything. Assassinations, weird names. I mean, some really weird names. Not just like, oh, they're foreign. No. Some of these names are ridiculous, and I will apologise for my pronunciation. My mouth isn't great at the minute, but we'll work it through. But yeah, it's got so much intrigue, desire, passion. Weird religious stuff, so much going on, family, just, oh, dynamics, oh my goodness. It's a lot happening, and it all revolves around one Marguerite de Valois. Now, this is going to shock you, but we actually have a date of birth, a woman from the past with a date of birth, a date and everything, not just like, I don't know, maybe July. No, an actual date. Because Marguerite de Valois was born on the 14th of May, 1553, at the Chateau de Saint-Marie-en-Laye. She was the seventh child and third daughter of Henry II of France and Catherine de Medici, who is absolutely going to be like having an episode. Might even have to split it into two. I don't know yet because she lived a life, and I'm not even going to cover much of Catherine here. Like, it's going to be like tidbits, if anything, which will show you just how much she just, again, women's wrongs, so much. She did so much. But yeah, Marguerite, I'm actually going to call her Margot for the majority of this episode because that's what she was known as during her lifetime. And I'm trying to get into the habit of doing this more, especially when I'm finding this out, because I don't know if you've listened to my Grainne Wheel, Grainne O'Malley episode, and my issue with the fact that her name is Grainne, or Grainne, depending on your pronunciation. But her name that she used during her lifetime should be the name that she is known by, because that's her fucking name. And that's why I'm working very hard to ensure that I do say the right name for everybody. And so Margot is what she was called, and that's what she called herself, so we'll just do that. And Margot, you know what? Bollocks it. We are gonna do it in chronological order because, I don't know, Brady Bunch it, I guess, is the best way to do it. So we have, in order of appearance, the children of Henry II of France and Catherine de' Medici. Francis II. Elizabeth, Queen of Spain. Claude, Duchess of Lorraine. Charles IX of France. Henry III of France. Margaret, Queen of France. And Francis, Duke of Anjou. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of kids here. Again, there's a bunch of them. But, how to put this? Royal families are weird at the best of times. But let's face it, King Henry was more into his mistress than anything else than Catherine de' Medici. Well, royal court was a power play after power play. Sneaking, schemes, a flying squad. Catherine de' Medici had a collection of maid servants, so on and so forth, ladies in waiting even, who were part of sort of this flying squad of hers. They were a spy ring, specifically under sort of the rule of Catherine de' Medici. And so she had them, like, all over court, just using them to find information and, you know, just help her out, you know what I mean? But back to Margot. So childhood starts at the royal nursery and she spends time with her older sisters, Elizabeth and Claude. Now, Elizabeth and Claude, they're much older than she is. So when they get betrothed and get ready to get married, you know, they go off. And she is sent to Château de Saint-Germain-en-Laye and Château d'Amboise. Again, I apologise for my pronunciation. And so she spends her time there with her brothers then. And growing up, she has a favourite brother, Henry. And so they grow up, like, pretty close. And it's Charles IX, actually, who gives her her nickname because he starts calling her Margot. Could he pronounce Marguerite? Were there just a fuck ton of Marguerites and he just couldn't be bothered? Perhaps. But that is where they're at. Now, when Margot is 6 years old, tragedy strikes and she has to witness, well, a horrific accident resulting in what I can only assume will be a lifetime of trauma. So when she's 6 years old, her father, King Henry II, dies. There is a jousting accident. He takes a lance to the eye. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen a lance. It's like a long pole. You should go watch A Knight's Tale. It's very fun. But yeah, effectively, he gets a lance to the eye, a splinter goes in, a chunk of the lance goes through his eye, into his brain, and it's a pretty horrific and unpleasant death, which is witnessed by all of the children, or at least all of the children that are still at court. So it is not a pleasant death, and at this point her oldest brother Francis I takes the throne. Now, Francis I, you may remember, was the weak and sickly sort of ruler who was married to Mary, Queen of Scots. Like, they were married, I don't know, not that long, and he dies of an ear infection because a lot of these kids, they're pretty sickly. And because when she's about seven, that's when he dies. So, like, a year after, he dies of an ear infection. And the next brother, heir and a spare, that Charles IX becomes king. And he's only 10. Like, this is a kid king, so naturally, he's ruling, but Catherine de' Medici is the one pulling the strings. Like, that's, we know that's happening. But all this stuff is going on. And, well, she is a princess. They have plans for her because, as we know, princesses are really good for anything other than alliances and building bonds and being used as a pawn to, you know, strengthen yourself and promote your own country and make money. And, you know, win wars and all that kind of other shit. You know, how does it work for you? So she needs to be educated well. And so she learn sort of grammar, history, classics, a lot of Bible stuff. So like she really knows Holy Scripture. Because remember, France, very Catholic country, you know, really into Jesus. And so they learn a lot of like religious stuff. And she's very competent in prose, poetry, dance, you know, the things you're supposed to have at court, these skills. And she also has pretty good horsemanship. Because of course she does, because, you know, skills. And yeah, so again about the whole religious thing, French court is sort of a yin and yang situation. Because it's super Catholic and everyone is acting all pious, so it's like very straight-laced at the front, but party in the back. So behind closed doors, it's wall-to-wall smut. There's sex, debauchery, the liaisons dangereuses, you know, shit's going down. The Catholics, I don't know if you've ever met a Catholic, if you haven't, they are absolutely filthy. Like there's this joke about Catholic schoolgirls, it's all the, you know, repression. And I don't know, the tartan uniforms, I assume. But like, there's all this repression and it just kind of comes out in hormones. And majority of the court, you know, they're not that old. So there's a lot going on. But yeah, most Christians are kind of dodgy in fairness, but Catholics are absolute horn dogs. So yeah, as she's growing up in court, you know, she's kind of aware of everything. They don't hide a lot from the kids because they didn't know to do that, because, you know, it's the past. But she does a lot of stuff. She goes on a grand tour with her family. They sort of, for 2 years, they travel around France to just kind of promote the king and the royal family and just, you know, try and show themselves off, build alliances, you know, so on and so forth. And because of all this sort of issues that were happening in France, there's, you know, religious segregation as it happens. You know, I mean, this is quite a tempestuous time, I must say. But Margot, she kind of learns sort of political mediation from her mother, Catherine de Medici. Like, she pays attention. She learns shit. And as she's getting older, you know, she is female and of royal blood, and as such, they need to find her a husband. And so they start these marriage negotiations with, like, Carlos, Prince of Asturias, Sebastian of Portugal, Archduke Rudolf. Like, they're trying to make these things happen, but they're not really landing anywhere. Things aren't going well. Now, growing up in royal court, so she would have spent time with, you know, all of, like, her siblings, but also people like Mary, Queen of Scots, and Henry of Navarre. So, it's not like a royal nursery, per se, but a lot of royals, they would send a child, to go stay with, like, other royals, other nobility, and they would be raised by them effectively, and this would, like, build sort of relationships and strengthen bonds. Unfortunately, Henry of Navarre, his mother Jeanne, she ain't happy he's there. Instead of seeing him like a ward of the royal family, she sees it effectively as kidnapping. Kind of like Theon in Game of Thrones, like when he's taken by the Starks. I don't know if you've watched Game of Thrones, but the Greyjoys, his family, basically see it as a kidnapping. They see it as like stealing like the last male heir. And Henry of Navarre, he is like the male heir of Navarre. And so, yeah, like they're keeping a hold of him to make sure he doesn't start any shit, or his family doesn't start any shit. There's just kind of issues there because Henry's family are, how do I put this? they're Huguenots. They're Protestants, effectively. And again, very Catholic country, and there's these Protestant sort of pockets happening. There's slight uprisings, and it's not greatly appreciated by the royals as such. And so by keeping him there, it kind of puts pressure on those sort of the Protestant side. Now, growing up in court, Henri of Navarre, he's not like the hottest guy. Like, he's fine, but he's not, you know, cool. Like, and I think as well, if you grow up with someone, they're less attractive to you, because it's like having a brother. Like, Mary Queen of Scots would have been like a sister to her, because she was trained to be like a French princess, as we have discussed before. But Henri, he's not that fun or interesting or smart, as far as any of the documents say. Like, I can't find anything that great about him. It just seems to be more convenient that he's there. And also, how many times do I have to say this? Your family tree should not be a wreath. Now, I don't know how close so much that the French royal family are, but clearly something's going wrong there, because the majority of sort of Henry II and Catherine de Medici's children were like sick and frail and just unwell in general, and none of them were any great beauty until Margot shows up, because she apparently was an absolute stunner. Her older siblings, they're fine, I guess. I mean, we know that Francis I, he was very sort of sickly and weak, and he was short, because I know that Mary Queen of Scots, like, she was pretty tall anyway, like, she was very tall for the era. But yeah, they weren't anything, you know, to shout home about. But you had dignitaries and foreign delegates who would write back home about how fucking gorgeous she was. She was so beautiful, she was referred to as the Pearl of Valois. Like, she had a great sense of style, she wasn't sick like her siblings, so she wasn't outwardly ill, she wasn't noticeably sick. And she was just beautiful, and she was fashionable, and she was, you know, the it girl of Valois. Like, I have to share this quote with you, because it's just, it's just amazing. The beauty of the princess is more divine than human. She is made to ruin men rather than to save them. Now, I don't want to be pernickety here, but I am going to be absolutely pernickety here. But this is basically calling her just a slut, effectively, because she's flirty, because, you know, courtly games of love are very much of this period. And so because she's flirty, and because she is gorgeous, and because she's just effervescent, she's just wanted and desired, and she plays on it a little. And naturally, you know, clearly, men do not like that. I'm not saying times have changed, but yeah. So when Margot is a little bit older, when they're about 14, 15, because there's not much age difference between Henri of Navarre and Margot. There's like a couple months, I think. So when he's about 14, 15, Jeanne, Henri of Navarre's mother, basically kidnaps him back, and she swipes him back to the palace in Navarre. And naturally, Catherine de' Medici is pissed, because she had been conned, and Jeanne of Navarre had used Catherine de Medici's money to abscond with Henri. Like, she had orchestrated it, and she'd used Catherine's money to do it. And, oh, if there's one person in the world you do not want to piss off in sort of medieval France, or Middle Ages France, Catherine de Medici, definitely one of them. Like, no, no, that's not a person you want to bother. Absolutely not. Like, you're digging your own grave there. So, during their teenage years anyway, so Enlai's gone for a bit, and during Margot's teenage years, like, she's really close to her brother Henry. So, I know there's so many Henrys, so I'm going to be like Henry and Henri because it's just easier. So her brother Henry, they're like really, really close, and it gets to the point that the Valois family, so this, I don't know, it's a, again, weird relationships. They are sort of scheming and sneaky, and there's a lot of like political backbiting, and a complete lack of trust and obsession with power seems to be going on here. So her brother Henry, he basically gets Margot to get close to their mother, Catherine de' Medici. Now Henry is, he's the favourite. He is the favourite child, he's the golden child, and he's very close to his mum. But when he's away, he has Margot sort of become very close to Catherine. Like, she is the first person in a room with her, last person out. She is helping her, getting involved in planning, because again, she's mainly ruling for Charles. Like, she's quote unquote advising him, because that's what Catherine de' Medici does. She just puppet master in the corner. And when Henry, her brother, has to go away, he leaves Margot in charge of his affairs, and she rules and plans and does all this stuff for him. But unfortunately, when she is there in court, there is the gorgeous Henry of Guise, de Guise, I should say. Not the geese. Those are dangerous and evil, and they will beat you in the face. And Navarre being gone, she's unbetrothed, she's a free agent, and there is this absolutely gorgeous, stunning, hot, sexy, older than her dude, and they kind of flirt and they do the usual stuff, kind of the courtly games of love. They're joking about, and you know, they're flirtatious in nature because she's a teenager, you know, it's what she does. Hormones. And rumors start circling around court, especially because De Guise's family have been caught up in, you know, a sticky wicket or two. And there is this conspiracy that the Guise family are planning to kidnap King Charles IX. So obviously that goes down like a lead balloon. And these rumors start spreading. And so Henry, he suspects a secret romance between Margot and De Guise. And there's rumors of like marriage plans. And there's all this, again, bullshit swirling around. But it's mainly just because they're hot young things and she's not an idiot and things are going well. So, unfortunately for Henry, De Guise is very popular around court. He's just, you know, ladies' man, man's man, man about town. He is adored. And Henry doesn't fucking like that. So when he comes back and he hears these rumours and he sees what's going on, he is not very happy with Margot, and this split happens. And again, when these rumours are going round, he basically creates this lasting brotherly hatred between Margot and himself. Because when the family discover, I say discover, when he dobs her in and accuses this of happening, like, De Guise being, you know, this older, like, teenage boy, could have easily started saying that he did do, you know, that he deflowered the fucking king's daughter. Like, he could say he did that, but yeah, no, didn't happen. And it's just bullshit spread around court, which was then fueled by Henry of Anjou, her brother, because he was a jealous fuck. So Marco had been getting close to her mother for 4 months, and she had become the favourite child. She had been learning Catherine's ways. But after Henrik of Anjou comes back all pissed off...
Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Sleep Cove podcast can help you. Hi, I'm Christopher Fitton, the voice and clinical hypnotherapist behind Sleep Cove. Sleep Cove features sleep hypnosis, meditations and bedtime stories, all designed to help those of you who struggle at night to achieve a restful and peaceful night's sleep. Search for Sleep Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see why Sleep Cove helps millions of people sleep deeply all night long.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Catherine is just done with this. She stops really communicating. She distances herself from her daughter, and she just goes back to having Henry of Anjou be her favourite. And all of this happens is because he snitched. He sets her up. He claims they were boinking and actively trying to wed, which she couldn't do anyway. Like, Margot can't do that. That's not an option for her. She can't get married without the king's permission. So, like, Charles has to agree before she can do anything. She has no power in this. She has no choice. And she, growing up in that court, would be well fucking aware of that. And marrying without the royal permission? Yeah, that's just fucking stupid. And Margot is not an idiot. But because Henry of Anjou was an absolute dickhead, this results in Margot being dragged out of her room and beaten at the request of the king, because again, these rumours then go back to Charles, who thinks that he has been publicly disgraced by his sister, that she was not following his rule. And these beatings keep happening. And it's absolutely shocking, because here's the thing. In the 16th century, in order for these political considerations to happen, in order for these agreements and arrangements to work out, the princess, a princess of royal birth, a noble-blooded king's daughter, she has to remain a virgin up until her wedding night. That is the rule. Like, that's it. End of discussion. You cannot have your honour disgraced. You cannot have the king's honour disgraced. I mean, I know she's the king's sister at this point, but still, you can't do that shit. Like, her life would not be worth living. And again, we've said over and over again, like, the easiest thing to gain and the hardest thing to lose, especially as a woman, especially throughout history, is a reputation. And this is the start of it. This is the start of calling her a whore, right? This is the beginning point. All because her brother was jealous. All because of that. Because he couldn't handle that she was popular and she was friends with somebody who was popular. Like, there's zero evidence of them having any kind of physical relationship at all. But yeah, she is getting the shit kicked out of her. But in order to nip this in the bud, she goes to her older sister, Claude, who has married into the De Guise family, and she begs and pleads her to convince Henry De Guise to marry someone, anyone, doesn't give a fuck who, like, anybody will do, pick one, because she needs these rumours to go to bed, excuse the pun, because, you know, she doesn't want to get beaten daily because she was polite to some cute dude at court. Like, she doesn't want that happening. I know I wouldn't want that happening. And I think, as you know, plans go, I think it's a fairly reasonable and acceptable one. Anywho, next thing you know, Henry de Guise gets married. Huzzah! Margot even attends the wedding. So clearly, no hard feelings there. Now, with this situation, yeah. Like most people who grew up with trauma, it can lead you to being, you know, less than trusting with people you should be able to trust, like friends and family. And this entire situation taught Margot a lesson that would stay with her for life. Now, she's a teenager, she is of the right age, and as such, it's time to start marriage negotiations. So, Catherine de' Medici, she is trying to arrange a marriage between Margot and Henry of Navarre. You know, because he's a Huguenot. A Calvinist, a Protestant, any of those. He's one of those things, right? And she is trying to arrange a marriage between the two, even though she fucking despises his mum, Jean. Unfortunately, over the years, Catherine had alienated a fuck ton of people for, you know, being a strong-willed woman in power who definitely poisoned a few enemies along the way. But anyway, there wasn't a lot of options left. And so there's this possibility that by marrying into the, you know, one of the leading Protestant people, they could stop some of this religious upheaval and, you know, war, religious war throughout the country. Perhaps, possibly, you know, work it out. So this union is aimed to strengthen sort of the family ties and end the French wars of religion between the Catholics and the Huguenots. And so France is basically in this civil war because of sectarianism, really? Yep, sectarianism. They're fighting because one of them believes in Mary, the other one doesn't. One likes statues, one doesn't want statues. Where do you keep the toaster? You know, it's weird, but it's a thing. Do you believe in the same God? Yeah. Oh, okay, cool, guys, yeah. It's such an odd one, but anyway, yeah, they're trying to, like, put a plaster over a gaping wound, you know, with this sort of marriage. So, on the 11th of April, 1572, Margot is betrothed to Henry, and they're both, like, 19 at this point. And, you know, it's expected that this is going to be like a popular union because of who's who. But, you know, again, the Catholic-Protestant divide, which I know this may shock you, caused some unrest. You know, a little bit of a controversy, and people were well mad at the thought of this union, effectively. And it was assumed that because Margot, being the woman in this scenario, would convert to her husband's religion, thus tainting the royal family or something. But yeah, no. See, Margot is proper Catholic, and she saw conversion as effectively setting herself up for eternal damnation. And she wasn't already super keen on marrying him, you know, one, for religious reasons, and two, because he was boring as fuck. But, you know, it didn't matter anyway because she's a princess. She exists as a political pawn to make, build and strengthen alliances. And as such, she has to do what she's told. She has to marry him. Like, that's the be all and end all of the situation. But what Catherine de' Medici does is she forces Henry of Navarre to convert. So he is forced to convert to Catholicism, even though he's a Protestant. Like, it's the situation. But this happens, like, a little bit later on. I'm skipping ahead a wee bit. So, this is... it's a weird wedding at the best of times. The service is unusual because Pope Gregory the 13th, he refuses to provide a dispensation for the wedding. Like, just straight up, he's like, no, I'm not allowing this to happen one way or the other. And it just gets weirder from here because Henri of Navarre is not Catholic. He's not even allowed to step foot in the Notre Dame Cathedral, so before he converts. And what happens is Henri of Anjou, you know, the brother that she fucking hates, has to stand in for him. Now, marriage by proxy is not unusual at the time, but having your brother stand in for your husband in a wedding ceremony, it's weird, okay? It's weird. And actually, the mother of the groom isn't at the wedding because she's dead. So they are engaged in, like, April. And then in June, Jean, Henry of Navarre's mother, dies out shopping for a wedding outfit. Now, the rumour is that because, you know, she had insulted Catherine by stealing back her son and stealing Catherine's money to do it, that, you know, Catherine de Medici held a fucking grudge and had her poisoned by way of gloves. So, of course, you know, you have to wear your gloves. They're, you know, part of your royal attire. So the theory goes that the gloves were lined with poison, and when she tried them on, dead. That's a theory anyway. So she dies, and because she's already, like, engaged to him, Margot becomes Queen of Navarre when Jean dies. Now, in August, 18th of August, 1572, at the Notre Dame Cathedral, Margot and Henry of Navarre are married. And, now, this is going to shock you. There's propaganda again. What? No, I know. You are surprised at this information. So there's this whisper going round that Charles IX forces this marriage, which, honestly, load of bollocks. Because, you know, he wanted an alliance and it was safer for everybody for this to be in place. Like, it made sense. This was a reasonable, like, union to have. But there's this theory that he, like, forced her head down to nod, which didn't happen. It just didn't happen. But yeah, it's, again, people are just mad about it because religious shit. And it almost becomes a red wedding situation. Too many Game of Thrones references in this, actually. So the celebrations last for a couple of days, because that's how, like, royal weddings work. Like, celebrations last for a period of time. And a lot of prominent Huguenots, they had come to Paris to celebrate this, because for them, this is a big step up, because their Protestant king, or a Protestant king, is marrying, you know, the Catholic princess of France. And so they're seeing this as a big win. And again, they're assuming Margot's going to convert. So there's this whole sort of idea happening. And a few days after the marriage, there is the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre. And because, again, a lot of these high-ranking Huguenots were in Paris, you know, for the wedding, for the celebrations, they're assassinated on the orders of one Catherine de Medici. So Catherine orders the assassination of this high-ranking Protestant general and frames the Huguenots. She frames the Protestants. But the plot thickens. Because how she does this is she also makes it seem like the Huguenots, the Protestants, were trying to frame her. So it's this sort of sticky, twisted, just knot of of web. It's complicated. It's just, in case anything does come back to her, she's made it look as if they're framing her. I mean, it's a smart plan and it worked. Like, it did work. Now, Margot was actually sitting with a bunch of these high-ranking Protestants. Like, she was spending time with them when this assassination occurred, so she knew a bunch of them weren't involved. So, because she was with so many of them during the time where the attack occurred, she knew they weren't part of this, and she actually has the only eyewitness account of the family. Like, she writes in her memoirs about this happening. And so when the massacre happens, when, you know, this uproar because the Protestants did this thing and, you know, they're blaming, you know, the Queen, Catherine de Medici, you know, they must be stopped. And, you know, when there's sort of religious tension, when there's sectarianism in any sort of society, they just are waiting for a spark to ignite the explosion. You know what I mean? They are ready to cause chaos. And that's what happens here. But Margot, she is in her beds one night. I think it's the day of sort of the massacre. And this huge note comes stumbling into her room, which, first of all, big no-no, you do not enter, you know, queen/princess's room uninvited, especially random man. No, that is a big no-no. And being the defiant queen that she is, she like leaps out of bed, kind of blurry-eyed, sees what's going on, sees this wounded dude, whom, as far as we can tell, doesn't know or doesn't know that well, and sees that he's being chased by like palace guards and archers and all this shit. And being the defiant bitch that she is, she jumps between him and the guards and she's like, don't you fucking touch him, not a chance. And so she basically saves his life and she tends to his wounds, and it gets to the point where she is bringing Huguenots into her rooms, her areas in the castle, because the guards can't cross her. They can't step in and fuck this up. You can't, you know, do anything to the king's sister. And so she saves just like a bunch of lives. Because, you know, she doesn't want a mass murder like on her doorstep. And she doesn't want involvement in it. But she feels that she's partly to blame for it. Like, again, because she's grown up with trauma. Like, and she's doing her best to just, protect these guys. And the St. Bartholomew's Massacre, because it happens on St. Bartholomew's Day, for the record, it is huge. Like, it starts in Paris, but then it spreads all over France. It is, you know, from the main city out to the countryside. And depending on the numbers, like, it's so fuzzy. Like, there's no definite sort of information. Like, from low to high, the guesstimations are between 5,000 and 30,000 Protestants are killed. And this fucks things up for them, really, because it tips the scales. There are so many prominent players assassinated that the Huguenot cause is just bollocksed up. And not only do you have like these main political figures just wiped out, you have this mass reconversion happening. So people are reconverting from Protestantism, Calvinism, Huguenots, whatever. They are converting back to Catholicism, you know, to save their skins, if nothing else. Even though conversion for a lot of people, like I said before, it's selling your soul. It's eternal damnation. You're going to burn in hell. Like, that's what they think they've signed up for now, because they're just trying to survive. And this is, again, where Henry of Navarre, this is where he converts, because Catherine de Medici's like, you know, you want to survive, you got to convert. So he does. But then she goes to Margot and she proposes an annulment of the marriage. you know, oh, look at this civil unrest, all of these issues. You know, it's almost as if she had planned this in advance in order to remove, you know, detractors and issues. You know, enemies, possibly. Who could say? Me. I'm saying it. She was involved. And knowing what's happened and feeling the way she's feeling, Margot says, fuck this for a game of soldiers. She's going to protect her husband because, as far as she's concerned, they have wed under the eyes of God. And so she has a duty. She's, again, proper Catholic, well religious. And so in order to save her husband's life, because she feels, again, responsible for the mass murder of all of these people, that she tells her mother that they cannot annul the marriage because, you know, she is his wife in every way. Now, chances are, as far as we can tell from, you know, all of the history, they hadn't consummated the marriage yet, but she had told her mother that to basically, you know, put him under her protection. But what's kind of sad and is that Henri of Navarre never knew she did this, like, throughout their time together. I mean, I feel like it could have helped things later on if we had the information, but nah. So anyway. But yeah, Margot, she says she shagged Henri of Navarre to save his life. I mean, it's not the worst lie one could make up in life. Now, with Henri of Navarre converting and effectively saved by Margot, he becomes an ally to the French crown. And he is sent away to trash rebellions and whatnot, leaving the 19-year-old Queen Margot at home at court. And so she creates the Muses of Paris. So she has a bunch of high-class ladies just being fabulous and stylish and congregating with great thinkers and artists of the day. And they are just, again, they're bright young things. They're having a fabulous time. And she is establishing salons and legit living her best life, having the time of her life even. Time of her life. And yet, well, you know, Henri's away, Margot will play. And she meets at one of her soirees, Joseph de Boniface, who was in his late 30s. Another ladies' man, man's man, man about town. And he woos her. By which I mean, he's pushing 40 and she's a fucking teenager. I don't care who you are, it's creepy as fuck. I don't care what era you're in, it's creepy as fuck. Like, I don't care. Ew. I will say it. Ew. I realise I went very Valley Girl there. I don't know where that came from, but it's happened now and we all have to accept it. So he is a pal of her wee brother Francis. And you're thinking, Francis, her brother? Isn't he dead? Well, okay, so young Francis here is originally Hercule, or Hercules. I'm not entirely sure which it is, but I'm going to go with Hercule. And he changes his name to Francis. For reasons. But anyway, they're friends and possibly lovers. And she starts up, I mean, I don't want to call it an affair, because, you know, it's a creepy older man with a teenage girl, and it just feels weird. It feels weird. But yeah, stuff happens there. Anyway, and when Margot is 20, King Charles IX, his health is, well, deteriorating is probably the best way to go, because his mental state is not great. And he gets very, very sick. And during this time, in order to keep Henry of Anjou, you know, not being an arsehole, he gets elected King of Poland. Because Henry of Anjou, he is very rigid, very strict in his particular belief system. And he's dealing with these uprisings in Poland. Because, you know, he has a thing for suppressing Protestant worship, doing what he does best, you know, be an absolute dick. He is crushing it all over the shop, And this leads to a plot by sort of the malcontent, who are these moderate Catholic lords, and they have this plan to put François of Alençon on the French throne, so younger brother Francis, because they're like, yeah, we can't be dealing with Charles because he's like mentally like fading away, and Henry over there, he's just being himself an absolute piece of shit. And so they're like, yeah, and François of Alençon, he is a bit more chill, he's a bit more lenient when it comes to sort of religious differences, and his willingness to compromise in religious matters makes him like a really good option, because a lot of people are just tired of bloodshed. Like, they're sick of violence and they want it to stop, you know, and he seems like a really good deal. So yeah, François and Henry of Navarre and the Catholics, the moderate Catholics, the reasonable Catholics, people who are sick of fighting, and the Protestants are arranging, orchestrating, planning a coup d'etat. They're planning a coup to usurp the throne, to put Francis on the throne and get rid of Henry III. And of course, Margot is about to stick her oar in and get involved. Now, this episode's been going on a little bit longer than I expected. This is going to end up being a two-parter because I was not expecting to talk this much. My goodness, I had a lot of notes. I'm sorry. And there's just so much. It's so much. I could easily talk about Queen Margot for like another 8 or 9 episodes. I could easily do it, but I'm not going to do that because there's other people I want to talk about. But I am going to finish this episode here and we will start with a coup next time. I really wasn't expecting us to get through this so quickly, but here we are. Yay, yikes, wow. Okay, so you can follow me on social media. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. Did I say Instagram? Threads? Is it Twitter now? Whatever Twitter is now. Come see my live show. It'd be great to see you. And recommendations. Oh my goodness. I am going to suggest that you read Lessons in Chemistry. Did I recommend that before? Maybe I did. Either way, read it. It's good fun. I say good fun. It's a bit intense in places, but it's a good read. For listening, no more Christmas music. I think we're done with it. But you know what I've been listening to a lot of recently is I started listening to the Midnights album by Taylor Swift again. I was just in the mood for it, you know? You should definitely do that. And for watching. Ooh, decisions. Oh. See, I haven't seen Echo yet, but I hear it's amazing. Oh, that feels ableist. It does, doesn't it? You know, but from what I have been told, it's meant to be an amazing show. So I'd say definitely give that a go. And yeah, that is the end of today's episode. And I am going to bid you farewell, and I will chat to you next time. I really wasn't expecting this to be a two-parter. I really wasn't. I was really hoping this was just going to be one, but then I realised just how much I was talking for, and I would like to formally apologise for that. I think as well, I'm not quite speaking properly. I'm not quite there yet. It's, again, just the issues are back, but it's fine. And we will get through this together. But adios. Au revoir. I've waited there, my friends. Bye-bye.